Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. What's the difference between our geopolitical enemies and our allies? Friendly U.S. relations with Saudi Arabia prove it's not a matter of shared culture. And our lack of concern over the nuclear weapons in Britain and France prove the capacity for aggression is not a deciding factor. My guest today believes the state of our national security is directly related to the state of our economic relationships. Lloyd Jeff Dumas is professor of political economy, economics, and public policy at the University of Texas at Dallas. He's recently back from Seoul, where he presented a paper on his views to the International Conference on Armed Forces and Conflict Resolution in a Globalizing World. Lloyd, welcome to Think.
It's nice to be here, Chris.
We should start with this definition because you do not see peace as simply the absence of war between two countries.
No, I don't. Peace also has to do with a relative feeling of security, that is, not feel under imminent threat. For example, the South and North Koreans have not officially been fighting since 1953, but in fact they're in a constant state of hostility and insecurity. Seoul is very close to the DMZ and that separates the two Koreas. There's always a feeling of threat in the air. And you could say the same thing about Israel and the Palestinians. They have fought with each other, but most of the time they're not actually fighting, but they're certainly worried about each other. They're nervous. They're not feeling at ease.
And when those conditions exist, no matter what one side or the other says, the other side is going to take it with suspicion and disdain.
Yes. When you think of somebody as, when you've learned to think of somebody as the bad guy, whatever they say, actually, even if it's something very nice, you take it as manipulative rather than an honest statement. So, in effect, it's very important to get past this bad guy mentality and realize that there is a way to get to everyone. And usually it has to do with producing mutual beneficial situations, situations where both people feel, both parties feel that they're gaining. That's what economics and economic relationships have a lot to do with this.
So it's very interesting to get there because we know how difficult it is to even get both sides to sit down sometimes for talks and to agree on the conditions for starting any kind of talks. But you say actually a step can be taken far before that. That's entirely unilateral.
Yes, there was in 1962 there was a communication psychologist named Charles Osgood who came up with an idea he called grit. Doesn't pay to go into all the details, but basically what he said was in communications behavior speaks louder than words, but the combination of the two is even better. So if you, in effect, want to reduce hostility between two countries, one way to do it is to make a series of statements, public statements, about your intention to reduce hostility and announce a series of unilateral initiatives in cultural areas, in military areas, in economic areas that you're going to carry out, and then do them when you say you're going to do them. And he talks, there's a lot more to it than this, but he talks about a lot about how to behave if you get the wrong reactions, if the other side seems to think that you're trying to take advantage of them. But Osgood's basic contention is that you can break down this bad guy mentality eventually. It takes persistence. It's very important to keep doing what you're doing, to do it right, to do it on time. But it can work, and there have been examples, actually. One very important historical example, in 1977, Anwar Sadat made a speech to the Egyptian parliament in which he said he would go anywhere in the world with no preconditions, including to the capital of Israel itself, to put an end to this hostility between Israel and Egypt. And that led to an invitation to come to Israel, speak to the parliament, which led to Menachem Begin, the Israeli prime minister, going to Egypt to speak to the Egyptian people. And within a few years, within 2 years actually, they had a peace treaty that no one would have predicted within 100 years between Egypt and Israel. So it can work. But it's very important after this initial hostility is lowered to bind the countries closer together with economic relationships of the right sort.
And when you say the right sort, they have to be balanced. And that concept is difficult when people think about one country that might have a great deal more economic power or more resources than the other. But in fact, it can be balanced as long as each side gets what it's gets back what it's putting in.
That's right. It comes down to fairness. You know, that sounds like a kind of touchy-feely thing to say, but in fact, we all have a very strong sense when we're not being treated fairly. We get provoked. We get antagonistic. And for instance, there is a game which is played by experimental economists, has been run all over the world, called the ultimatum game, in which one party is asked to offer a deal to the other party. Let's say you have $100, and you're asked to offer it to me, a split of this $100. You can say, I'll keep 99%, you get 1%, you can say it's 50-50, whatever you like. And then I respond, if I don't take the deal, neither of us gets anything. Now, economic theory generally predicts that if you gain anything, you would take the deal. So if you offered me 99% for you and $1 for me, I'd take it. But it's not true. It turns out that more than half the respondents, when they're offered 30% or less, just walk away. They take nothing rather than being treated unfairly. This goes across cultures in many different countries. So there's an idea of when you build economic relationships between nations, if you want that to help build security and to bind countries together, you have to see that the relationships are balanced, really in two ways. Balanced in terms of gain and benefit, but also balanced in terms of decision power and control over the relationship. Because if there's a relationship, even if it's balanced in benefit between you and I, but I have all the control, I can change it any way I want, any time I want, you're still not going to feel secure. You're not going to feel like a partner. You're going to feel like a subordinate. So it becomes very important to balance the decision power as well. One example, for instance, is that Israel and the Palestinians actually have a lot of economic interactions, but they're totally one-sided. They're completely dominated by the Israelis. The Israelis can shut the border anytime they want. They've done it. They collect taxes, which they then give to the Palestinian Authority. They stop giving the taxes anytime they want. They do that when they feel provoked. I'm not saying that the Israelis do this just out of the blue sky. But the fact is, that kind of relationship doesn't build a partnership. It doesn't create the kind of feeling of equality and the feeling of mutual positive mutual relationships that are created by balanced relationships where both parties know that nothing's going to happen unless they both agree.
And those positive relationships, I guess, start on the very lowest levels. They don't necessarily have to take place initially between leaders of these states. They can be the people who are calling each other to do business and sort of get to know the names of each other's kids and things as simple as that.
That's true. When you have these kinds of relationships, I mean, let's take an example just to show that this isn't just a nice idea. It's an operating reality. The European Union was formed for this reason. It began as the European Coal and Steel Community in 1952. And it began because France and Germany had repeatedly fought with each other. And it occurred to somebody that if we get them together in a set of mutually balanced economic relations, they might stop it. They might actually get along together better. Part of the reason, and of course it's working, the European Union by the mid-1980s contained countries like Britain and Italy and Germany and France and the Netherlands and Belgium and Portugal and Spain, who were all colonial masters. They fought countless wars with each other over the centuries, but they don't even think about fighting anymore or threatening each other militarily. And they don't agree about everything either. It's not that they've suddenly all become peaceful. They've fought wars with other people. It's because they have such a web of strong, balanced relationships among them, no one wants to ruin it. And so when they have conflicts over British mad cow disease and their beef, over the euro, over whether the war in Iraq, the invasion of Iraq, is a good thing to do and you should be part of it or not. I mean, Britain, for instance, and Spain were on the pro-war side, and France and Germany were on the anti-war side, but it still didn't disrupt their relationships with each other because they all have too much to gain by these kinds of relationships. That's why the EU was originally established, and it works. So when I was in Korea, for instance, I recommended to the Koreans that they think about ways of balancing the economic relationships they have with the North. They have, fortunately, since the last 20 years, developed some economic relations, but mostly they're dominated by South Korea, and mostly they have the character more of giving someone who's down on their luck a hand. Well, that's fine. That's a good thing to do. but it's not as good as making them feel like they have some dignity, like they're a partner in the relationship. That will bind the Koreas together much more tightly. And fortunately, some of the professors to whom I spoke in Korea said they want to think about how to do this in the Korean cultural and political and economic context. One of the things I should say just incidentally is that outside experts have to be careful what they do, because you really have to understand the culture and the society and the economy of a place before you intervene. So what I tried to do is give some general ideas and leave it to the Koreans to work out the details. They know each other better than I know either of them.
You've pointed out that just about all of the wars that have been fought since the end of the Second World War have taken place in developing countries.
Yes.
What should we take from that?
I think what it means is that people who are in desperate economic conditions are more likely to resort to violence. They're more likely to fall prey to demagogues who tell them, it's not your fault, you're in trouble, you know, it's somebody else's fault, go get them. After all, that's what Hitler did with the collapse of Germany's economy between the two world wars. That's a very appealing message, but people who are in good economic condition have too much to lose to just go running off and fighting wars. They're more hesitant to do it. It's not that they won't do it under certain conditions. Wars happen for all sorts of reasons, and I'm not even beginning to claim that better economic relations will prevent war entirely, but it will take us a long distance in that direction.
And I would imagine better economic conditions and more equality between countries might help as well?
Yeah, it's, as you mentioned earlier, it's much easier to establish balanced relationships between, say, France and Germany, or between the United States and Canada, than it is between the United States and Haiti, for instance, because there's so much higher level of development in one place than the other. It's not impossible to find ways of having balanced relationships, but it's very difficult. That's, in fact, one of the problems between South and North Korea. There's such a difference in level of development between the two. So if we can bring up the level of development of the poorer countries in the world, I think we'll do ourselves a tremendous favor. And you know what I said, we'll do ourselves a tremendous favor, because we'll create a situation where it's easier to balance relationships and easier, therefore, to prevent people from marching off to war whenever they get angry about something.
Have you thought about what you would advise the U.S. government to do with regard to its relationship with North Korea?
Well, certainly putting North Korea on a list of the evil axis was not a good idea, because when you take a country that's already somewhat paranoid and make them more paranoid, they don't behave the way you'd like them to. It's sort of like if someone breaks into your house and they're holding a gun and you surprise them, you don't want to make them nervous. It doesn't matter that they're wrong, that they shouldn't be there, that they're doing the wrong thing. You still have to think about how to get them to behave in a way that's positive toward you. And you don't do that with these kinds of threats. So I think actually I'd advise the U.S. government to encourage the South to develop these kinds of relationships with the North, to move in the direction of making them more like partnerships. And there are possibilities. For instance, not just South Korea and North Korea, but also China and Russia and Japan would gain by improving the transportation infrastructure through Korea and the Korean Peninsula. They all use those routes. And they have to go around in big circles to get from one place to the other because of the hostility in Korea. So there is reason for all of them to get together and try to establish some infrastructure projects to build more roads, to improve the rail system and so on between the countries. And they can do that in a way that treats North Korea as a partner, not just as someone who is a subordinate to everybody else. I think they can make some progress. I'm not saying it's easy. This is very difficult to do. I think actually the Israeli-Palestinian situation and the North-South Korean situation are two of the most difficult in the world to deal with. So I'm not minimizing that. But I think if we move in this direction and if we're patient, it won't happen overnight, we can make real solid progress that way.
When we talk about improving relations by improving trade conditions, it's interesting to me, because I think about many of the countries with whom the U.S. has long-standing conflict, places like Iran and Cuba, and very often the first thing we do is cut economic ties.
Yeah, that's our impulse, is to say that we're doing them a favor by having these economic relations, so let's cut the relations. But actually, the point that you mentioned earlier is very important. When you have ongoing economic relations between two countries, you don't just have the governments relating to each other. You have people, business people in both countries relating. They talk on the phone. They send emails to each other. They sometimes visit each other's country. when they do that, they get more of a feeling of each other as people rather than some stereotypical enemy. And the result is it makes it harder to justify fighting with someone. It doesn't make it harder to justify arguing with them or trying to negotiate with them. But it lowers the threshold of at which people will, well, let me say it the other way, it raises the threshold at which people will go to war. So I think when you cut off relations, you're cutting off more than just economic flows. You're also cutting off contact between people. And this kind of interpersonal contact is very important to building bridges between countries. I should also say that even in countries that are hostile, there are always people, even in the government of that country, who are not as hostile. And the national policy should always be to strengthen the hands of those who look most kindly toward you, rather than making it easy for the bad guys, the worst of the bad guys, to get control and to do what they want to do.
Do you think there's any possibility that the countries with whom we have cut economic ties could make the first step toward us?
It's possible, but I don't think we should wait for it. I mean, the fact is, this idea of unilateral initiatives works no matter who starts it, but it works better if both sides are intent on improving the relationship. And again, I want to emphasize, I'm not talking about giving aid and comfort to the enemy. I'm not talking about handing people money or handing people resources. I'm talking about building relationships in which there is trade, in which there is investment in both places, in which there is a connection between people to which they both feel that they are gaining and both feel that they have control. They have important input into the decisions made on the relationship.
Great ideas. Lloyd, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Chris.
Just ahead on Think, why North Texas air quality is so poor in the summer and how you can help improve it. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seat calendar for this weekend includes classic stagecraft, an opening in Oak Cliff, and the art of the urban landscape. Opening at the Public Trust, it's their first solo exhibition for former tag artist Tony Bones and his works in various media, including neon, paintings, woodcuts, and the artist's first ever print editions. Mighty Fine Arts in Oak Cliff invites you out for the opening of Good and Gooder, featuring paintings and musings from Polly Perez, as well as computer and video artist Eric Tostin slaps at the consumer culture. On stage at the Contemporary Theater of Dallas, it's time for the travails of Blanche Stanley and Stella, and Tennessee Williams' Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning masterpiece, A Streetcar Named Desire, directed by Rene Moreno. And going back in time a bit, the Fort Worth Community Arts Center plays host to the Stolen Shakespeare Guild's production of the romantic comedy The Tempest, wrapping up this weekend in the Sanders Theater. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
How clean or polluted is the air we breathe? The EPA says 8 North Texas counties, including Dallas, Tarrant, Collin, and Denton, have higher than healthy ozone levels. That increases our problems with asthma and other breathing problems and can make it unsafe to be outside. But environmentalists say we can make a difference if we choose to take action. Laura Cole is Public Involvement Manager at the North Texas Council of Governments, which recently launched a region-wide campaign called Air North Texas. Laura, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So North Texas is a moderate non-attainment zone for ozone. What does that mean?
That is correct. Air quality in the region is designated as a non-attainment for the pollutant ozone. That's the standard set by the Environmental Protection Agency. And that means that we are exceeding their maximum allowable levels of the pollutant ozone. Ozone is especially harmful to us when we breathe, especially for folks with compromised respiratory problems such as asthma. Ozone is primarily caused by the emissions caused by our on-road and off-road vehicles. And so this campaign, Air North Texas, is aimed at educating and motivating our public to make simple lifestyle choices and to help us improve the air quality in the region.
Is having bad air quality, in addition to the health risks, are there also sanctions that come along with staying in the non-attainment range?
There could be. Air quality in the region has been a problem for a number of years, and the North Texas region, like I said, is qualified as non-attainment. It could possibly...
In other words, if we there are some funding things tied to making sure that we have
absolutely the region could face some possible sanctions, but it also comes down to the lifestyle impacts of our region, our residents as well. It could also adversely impact our air quality, our health problems, lifestyle choices that we make.
So if we want to cut our ozone, it makes sense to try and stop using our personal vehicles quite so much. Is there enough public transit if everybody, or even a significant percentage of people in this area decided that they wanted to take public transit to work?
Public transit is one of the choices that people can take to reduce the vehicle miles that they travel every day. There's also a lot of other choices that people can make. It comes down to deciding what kind of choices fit your personal lifestyle. It could be as easy as maintaining your vehicle, keeping your tires properly inflated, changing your oil on a regular basis. Anything to make your vehicle run more efficiently will reduce the amount of emissions that you produce. Also, how are you planning your daily trips? Can you reduce the number of vehicle miles that you travel? Do you have to go to the bank and then come home, and then go to the grocery store and come home, and then go to the dry cleaner and come home? Can you combine those trips into one and reduce the amount of miles that you travel and therefore reduce the emissions that you produce? Also, can you possibly combine trips with a colleague or a neighbor? Can you carpool or vanpool to work? That's going to reduce the number of miles that we travel in the region and reduce congestion, save you money on gas, and also reduce the emissions that you produce.
Any good ideas for finding somebody who'd want to carpool? Sometimes we don't know someone in our office who lives
Absolutely.
In our neighborhood.
There's a couple of different ways you can do that. You can either start a vanpool or carpool program through your employer, or a couple of our transit agencies in the region, both the DART and the T, offer vanpool and carpool rideshare matching programs. They sponsor vanpool programs, so they can help you find people that live and work near you that you can rideshare with.
Is telecommuting actually gaining hold? We keep hearing about it.
It is gaining hold, and that's, again, another one of the many options that people in the region can use to reduce the vehicle miles that they travel. We have some resources on the airnorthtexas.org website that employers can go to if they want to learn more about how they can start a telecommuting program at their place of employment. I know there are some employers that may be a little bit hesitant of letting their employees work from home either on a regular basis or maybe one day a week, but they can go out to the website and learn more about what that program entails and how that's going to help us improve the air quality in the region. Also, it helps to add another incentive to their employees. I know the organization that I work for, the North Central Texas Council of Governments, we encourage our employees to telecommute once a week. That, you know, reduces the amount of miles that they have to travel to and from work, reduces congestion, helps us save on gas, and reduces emissions.
So for those of us lucky enough to live close enough to work or school or errands to walk or bike, sometimes the impediment is as simple as the traffic conditions are just really scary if you're on foot or on a bicycle. Are there any long-term plans for the region to create designated spaces for people who are not in cars?
Absolutely. Part of our regional transportation plan, the Metropolitan Transportation Plan, calls for a regional veloweb. That's an interconnected path for bike and pedestrian. There's already a number of trails throughout the region specifically for bike and walking, both on road and in dedicated trails. If people want to see where those trails are currently on the ground and also where they're planned, they can go out to the airnorthtexas.org website. They can find a link to the North Central Texas Council of Governments page, and they can find more about bike and pedestrian planning there.
I guess this could also maybe help with our traffic issues as well.
Absolutely. The less vehicle miles that we're all traveling is going to reduce congestion on our already very congested roadways. It's going to help save us gas, as gas, you know, continues to accelerate close to $4 a gallon, and it's going to help reduce the emissions and improve our air quality.
Hard to argue with any of that.
Absolutely.
Laura, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
You can learn more about ozone pollution and its remedies at airnorthtexas.org. If you have something to say about the show, send an email to think@kera.org. You can find free podcasts at kera.org/think. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.